Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon for the purpose of having two-way conversations with our audience. You have to use your telephone and call in if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, or if you have a different viewpoint from our host. And we'd be glad to hear from you. Let me just remind you that when you do call in, have your question ready and be as succinct as possible. Remember, we're on the air, and there's a lot of people waiting in line to be on the air behind you, and airtime is expensive, so let's help us to economize it by getting as quickly as possible to an intelligible question. So you might find it best if you're challenged in doing that to perhaps write down your question in advance and you can read it, or feel free to do it to wing it if you can be succinct, of course. And I want to just say we're doing something a little different today because we have one of our computers is down, and I'm not able to see as I usually am who the callers are who are waiting. But my call screener can. Trouble is he's in Portland, Oregon, and I am in Southern California always. So we have that communication usually between two computers, and their computer is at the point of not being responsive to us. So I'm going to have to be taking audio cues from the call screen. That's no big problem to you. It just changes the way the program sounds because I'll have to interact with the call screener a little bit in ways that you'll be able to hear. But that's not an issue. Our first caller today is Robert from Atlanta, Georgia. So let's go directly to the phones. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Steve. Welcome. Thank you for having me on. Trivia question. Two questions, actually. When you're on the in your car driving, do you listen to radio Christian stations to other sermons or other Christian broadcasts?
Well, not usually anymore. I often listen to audio books while I'm driving. Or occasionally maybe a podcast of somebody. So I'm not really listening to Christian radio very much of the time, although I do if there's something on there that I find interesting. I'll listen for a moment to when I'm in the car and see if there's something interesting. Otherwise, I'll listen to something else.
Mm-hmm. All right, second question is, and it's not very important, are you familiar with, you probably will not be, but I want to ask anyway, minister Steve Brown or Alistair Begg?
Sure. I've heard them both many times.
Well, what's your view of them? Good. I know you're not going to say anything negative, but I'm just curious what you think of them.
Well, I have to say I love Alistair Begg's accent. And I tell you, anyone who's got a Scottish accent like that gets a lot of points for listenability. And he's a good man. He's a good, Bible-believing man. I believe he's a Calvinist, which is different than me, and might hold some other views different than me, but then I expect that in other, preachers. I don't expect them to all agree with me, so that wouldn't be a criticism so much as an observation. Steve Brown, I believe, is Presbyterian, if I'm not mistaken. I think he's certainly Calvinist, too, though I have to say I don't hear these guys teaching those subjects as any kind of an emphasis. So I haven't really heard either of them say much of anything I would disagree with. So, I would say if you find their broadcast edifying, then listen and support them.
Oh, I do, very much so. I just, I don't know much about Steve Brown, so I thought I might ask. Thank you very much.
He's got a great voice, too. He and Alistair Begg.
You have a nice, take care. Thank you, my friend.
All right. God bless you. Thanks for your call. Okay, Sam, who's next?
Next, we have Jacob from Puyallup.
Okay, Jacob from Puyallup, Washington. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Daniel 9:27 talks about the covenant with the many. And in the verse prior, it talks about the Messiah and it talks about a prince. I'm not sure who this covenant with the many is between, and I can take your answer off there.
Okay. Thank you, Jacob, for your call. Well, Daniel 9 is the famous prophecy of the 70 weeks, and that's in chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. And there are two very, very different ways that this has been approached by evangelical Christians. The passage is essentially telling, an angel is telling Daniel that there's going to be a 490-year period of God's dealing with Daniel's people, Israel. And this comes in the context of Daniel has just been reading Jeremiah's prophecy that Israel would spend 70 years in captivity in Babylon. Now, Daniel was living at the end of that period and reading about that, so he's encouraged from the prophecy that their period of captivity was near its end, and he was praying and fasting for insight, and an angel gave him a revelation about the future of his people Israel. Israel had just been through a 70-year captivity, and the angel said, well, God's going to deal with them for 70 times 7 more years. In many English translations, says 70 weeks. The word week in the Hebrew is heptad, or a 77s. And I don't know of any commentator who would argue that this does not refer to periods of 7 years as opposed to 7 days. So a week is a period of 7 years. And there's going to be 70 of those, just like there had been 70 years of them in captivity. So there's going to be 70 times 7 years after their captivity. And it's going to begin with the command of a king to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, which marks the end of the captivity. And they get to go back to Jerusalem from Babylon and rebuild it. And it'd be 490 years, really, from that point until the Messiah comes. And that 490 years is broken up into three parts. It talks about 7 weeks, which would be 49 years, and then 62 weeks, which is, again, 62 times 7 years. So there you've got, with 7 weeks and 62 weeks, you've got 69 weeks total. That's 483 years. And that leaves only 1 week or 7 years remaining after those first two segments. Now, the 70th week of Daniel, like the other weeks, is 7 years long, because a week is a seven-year period in this prophecy. So we've got the 7 weeks, and we've got the 62 weeks, and then we've got 1 week, and that totals 70 weeks total. Now, I said this is taken very differently by different Christians. Many Christians believe that the 69 of the first 69 weeks, they run, they run just fine chronologically until they get to the end of the 69th week. But that the 70th week, they would argue, did not begin after the 69th week. And they would say what happened was that Jesus came to Israel at the end of the 69th week, offering himself as the Messiah in the triumphal entry on Palm Sunday, and the Jews rejected him. And so actually what happened was that they would say the 70th week didn't happen because the Jews rejected the Messiah. The 70th week, the last 7 years of the 490-year period, was postponed, they say. And they assign to that period the future tribulation that is discussed so much in dispensational prophecy. So they believe that there's been 69 of those weeks, that's 483 years of the prophecy, that were fulfilled from Daniel's time, essentially, till Jesus came. But that the last 7 years, the last week, was postponed and did not happen and remains to happen in the last 7 years prior to the coming of Christ. And that's where they get the idea of a seven-year tribulation. You know, there's nothing in the Bible ever mentions a seven-year tribulation. Jesus said there would be great tribulation in Matthew 24:21, and Revelation 7:14 mentions great tribulation, but neither tells how long the tribulation is. In fact, no place in the Bible tells us how long the tribulation is, but because many people identify the tribulation with the 70th week of Daniel, which is a little bit arbitrary, but that's what they do, they have concluded that the tribulation is that period of time, which is 7 years. So it's really an assumption based on the identification of two different things in the Bible that aren't necessarily identified with each other in the Bible. Okay, now, in that case, the question is, when it says he shall make a covenant, or he'll confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, I think everyone agrees that that 1 week refers to the 70th week, because Daniel has already been told about the first 69 weeks. And then it says, he shall confirm the a firm covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and offerings to cease. Now, dispensational popular teaching on this thinks that he, the one who confirms the covenant with many for a week and then break and then ends the sacrificial system in the middle of the week, they say that's a reference to the Antichrist. They say this is in a future tribulation period, that the 7 years will begin with a future Antichrist making a covenant with Israel, which they understand to be some kind of a peace treaty, a mutual non-aggressions pact, or some kind of thing, some kind of a treaty of peace between Israel and the Antichrist, whom they think is going to be governing 10 nations in Europe in a confederacy. But that the Antichrist is dishonest, and they say he'll break the covenant after 3.5 years, and he'll destroy the newly rebuilt temple, which his first decree had allowed Israel to build. They rebuild it, and then he's going to destroy it, or at least defile it, by putting an image of himself in it. This is the standard dispensational teaching you get from most radio preachers, most popular books on prophecy, certainly all the prophecy novels, perhaps except for Hank Hanegraaff's prophecy novels, but most of the popular ones, Tim LaHaye's and Hal Lindsey's and so forth, these all reflect this idea that he who makes a firm covenant with many is a future Antichrist at a future time, who will make a 7-year peace treaty with Israel, but they say he'll break it and defile the temple, and just like Antiochus Epiphanes did back in 168 BC, the Antichrist will defile it by putting an idolatrous image in the temple, and that'll prevent the Jews from using the temple anymore, and he'll cause the sacrifice and offerings to cease. So that's how almost all popular prophecy teachers teach it, and I will tell you, that's how I taught it back when I was a dispensationalist. That's the only view I ever heard. I didn't know there was any other way to look at it. What happened, though, is I moved away from my dispensational church. I simply moved to another area where they didn't have a Calvary Chapel, which I had been under. And then I had to read the Bible on my own. I remembered what they had said, but I didn't have them continually reinforcing their interpretation. So I actually read the Bible with a little bit clearer objectivity, and I realized that there's no mention in the passage at all of any Antichrist. There simply is no hint of an Antichrist in the prophecy of the 70 weeks. So when it says in verse 27, he will confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, the word he is a pronoun, and pronouns have to have an antecedent. Now, again, the dispensational view is the antecedent is the Antichrist. He is the Antichrist. The problem is there's no mention of any Antichrist in the whole passage. And the most reasonable antecedent is the person who's been discussed in the entire segment, verse 24 through 27, about the 70 weeks. The famous and central figure is the Messiah. He's mentioned in verse 25. He's mentioned in verse 26. But there's no Antichrist mentioned. Now, dispensationalists say, well, no, there is. He's just not called that, because in verse 26, it says that after the Messiah is cut off, the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now, after Jesus died, the city of Jerusalem and the Jewish temple was destroyed by the Romans. And therefore, the people of the prince who is to come who destroyed it were the Romans in 70 AD. But the dispensation says, well, true, the Romans did it, but they were the people of this prince who is to come. And the prince who is to come is a future Antichrist. So he's going to have some Roman connections, because it was his people who did it and they were Romans. But they say he's future. Now, there's nothing in the passage that suggests for a moment that the prince who is to come lived thousands of years after the people of the prince who is to come. There's no suggestion at all that the prince who is to come is an Antichrist, especially when the most natural reading of it is simply that the Romans would destroy the temple. And they did. So, I mean, this is all fulfilled. And there's not the slightest hint that some future Antichrist figure is in view. Also, the prince who is to come, whom the dispensationalists believe is the Antichrist, is not even so prominent in the passage as to be the subject of a sentence. He's not even a subject of any of the sentences. He's the object of a preposition. It's not the prince who is to come. It's the people of the prince who is to come who are in focus here as the ones who destroy the city and the sanctuary. The prince is simply a descriptive, you know, basically adjective. You know, these people are his people. But the prince who is to come, who's mentioned there, you know, in passing, simply is not a focal point of the passage at all. But the Messiah is. So it'd be very strange if the pronoun he, which appears in verse 27, referred back to this prince who is to come when he has not been very focused on at any point, and the Messiah has been. So suppose we assume that the he who confirms the covenant with many for a week is Jesus, is the Messiah. And it says, and in the middle of the week, that's after 3.5 years, he'll bring an end to the sacrifice and offering. Well, did Jesus bring an end to the sacrifice and offering as far as God is concerned? Well, he certainly did. His death was the last of the sacrifices. If we read the book of Hebrews, there's never been an animal sacrifice after the sacrifice of Christ that was necessary or valid. True, some of the Jewish Christians still practiced animal sacrifice. The Gentiles didn't, but the ones in Jerusalem did until the temple was destroyed. But Jesus really brought an end to the sacrificial system with his own death. That's Christian theology. So why not recognize that the person who's the focus of the passage has been from beginning to end of the passage, the Messiah. And he's the one who, after 3.5 years of his ministry, brings an end to the sacrificial system by his death. His death is mentioned, after all, in the previous verse. It says the Messiah will be cut off. And so, to me, it's most natural to see he's the one who confirms the covenant. After all, Jesus came as a result of the covenant God made with Abraham. God said that the seed of Abraham would come, who would bless all nations. That was Jesus. He came. And at his baptism, the Holy Spirit came upon him, and he began to function as that, you know, fulfillment of that covenant. And it was a 7-year potential covenant. This is how long it's, remember, the period of time is how long God's dealing with Israel. And God has dealt with Israel from the time of, you know, Moses till the time of the destruction of the temple. But he dealt exclusively with Israel. And any Gentile who wanted to be part of that had to become part of Israel, frankly, until Jesus came. And when Jesus came, eventually the gospel went out to the Gentiles. Not immediately, though. After Pentecost, it was a few years before God called an apostle distinctly to the Gentiles, named Paul, or Saul. And so I believe that when Jesus was baptized, there were 7 more years in which God was going to deal with Israel fairly exclusively. And that was the case. Jesus, in the middle of that period of time, died, brought an end to the sacrificial system, its legitimacy. And for some, maybe another 3.5 years, probably, it was still, all the Christians were Jewish. God was not yet going to the Gentiles. This whole period of 490 years was God's dealing with Daniel's people, Israel. But once he sent Saul out to the nations, well, then God was dealing with the whole world and not just Israel. So that's how I understand that. I know that's a little complicated, but I can't help it. I didn't write it. It's a complicated passage. Okay, thanks for your call, Jacob. Who's next?
Okay, Steve, next we actually have Max from Portland, Oregon.
Okay, Max from Portland, Oregon, our atheist friend. Good to hear from you, Max.
Hey, good to talk to you, Steve. Yeah. Hope you're doing well. Hey, yeah. I want to be brief in my question. I just sort of have an impression of many Christians, many evangelicals, and that is sort of an aversion to the either significance or even existence of climate change. People in London, obviously in Europe right now, are experiencing the peak temperatures, as well as people in Utah and so forth, and in Texas, et cetera. I was wondering if what your opinions on climate change are. Maybe it's a sign of the end of the times. Maybe it's just a hoax. What do you think about it? Is there a biblical perspective on it even?
Right. Yeah, I don't believe that Christians are more skeptical about climate change than, say, non-Christians are. I would say I'd say there's a difference of opinion among people who study it about whether climate change is really primarily caused by people or whether it's a natural phenomenon. Apparently, I'm no climatologist or meteorologist or anything like that, but I've heard from, you know, as good as authorities as on the other side, that climate change is a cyclic thing. It goes in cycles, and it's been doing it for thousands of years throughout history. Some would say billions of years, and that it happens through a lot of causes, and that man's activities are a very minor cause of it. For example, they say when Mount St. Helens, the volcano, blew up, and you know that was up near where you live, but I don't know if you're old enough to have been around when it happened, but I was. They say that put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than, you know, the industrial nations of the world do in 100 years, just that one eruption. And, of course, there's been volcanic eruptions throughout history. And so, you know, it's questionable whether man's industrialization has made a significant contribution to climate change. So that's what's disputed. I don't know that anyone really doubts that climate change happens. Anyone who's lived as long as I have has lived through seasons where there's some rather mild winters and some rather mild summers and then some severe ones. Climate does change from year to year, and sometimes over a period of maybe several decades, there's a trend. That's not a challenge to Christianity. It's not a challenge to, and I don't see any reason why Christians would have any reason to dispute that. You know, I don't think they would. At least I don't, and I've never seen any reason why Christians would. I think what is under dispute is not whether there's climate change, but whether, let's just say, whether it's going only one direction. In other words, is the climate getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter until we're all going to burn like crisp, like bacon here? Or does it get hotter and hotter and hotter for a while, then it gets cooler and cooler and cooler for a while, then it goes hotter and hotter again? I mean, that's the cyclic nature of it. And the question of whether our industrial activities really make a significant impact on it is also questionable. And not questionable, it's not like Christians are on one side of this and non-Christians on the other. It's that there are scientists on both sides. One reason we hear a lot more from the alarmist climate change scientists in many cases is because we go through times where some scientific opinions are more politically correct than others. And we are certainly living at a time where, the prevailing intelligentsia in the Western world are pretty much against fossil fuels and things like that for various reasons. And the one that the reason they give is because of climate change. However, it's very clear they're not really sincere about that because, the manufacture of batteries for electric cars, which they so often recommend, takes, you know, as much industrial effort and gives off carbon dioxide stuff as much as, gasoline does. So there's a lot of inconsistencies in a lot of what we hear. And I'm not an expert. I don't know to what degree human activity affects climate change. But I do believe that there's scientists who are every bit as good as the ones who are saying the political correct stuff. Who say, you know, yeah, okay, it's changing. It'll change back eventually. And not much we do is going to have much impact on it. And not all Christians would agree with me on that. There's Christians on both sides of that. But that would be my own tendency, would just say, well, I've heard some evidence that we're not really making that much of an impact on it.
Well, I certainly hope that the church will play a role in the humanitarian relief front of assisting people who are suffering from a world which will be suffering the effects of climate change in the future.
Well, you can be pretty sure that will be the case because that has been the case for the last hundreds of years. The primary humanitarian efforts to the world in disasters has been from Christian agencies. Not all. Certainly there's humanitarian agencies that are not Christian, but the vast majority of charity that's given to the poor, the vast majority of responses, for example, that went down to New Orleans after Katrina, is very typical of what usually happens in these crises, you know, church groups go down to help rebuild. And yeah, there's you don't have to worry about Christians being involved in relief. You might be more have more reason to be concerned about anyone who's not a Christian getting involved, because there's less and less transcendental interest in human life in the non-religious community as time goes by, which is why why human life is taken so casually by so many people. Hey, I appreciate your call. The music's playing. I need to take a break, but it's always good to talk to you. We'll do it again. All right. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. We have another half hour coming. We're not really done with the program, but we take a break at the middle to let you know that we pay a lot of money to radio stations, and we don't sell anything or have any sponsors. It's amazing that we're able to pay, because it's about $100,000 a month, and yet we don't sell anything or advertise. We don't even have fundraising efforts. I just let you know every day we are listener-supported. If you'd like to help keep us on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. And or you can go to the website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds, so don't go away. We've got another half hour coming up.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to study, learn, and enjoy by visiting thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Remember, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour. We're taking your calls as usual. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, we'd be glad to hear from you. You can ask those questions here. We'll talk about them here. If you see things differently than the host, we'll talk about that if you call in. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. All right, our next caller is Paul from Delray Oaks, California. Paul, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Good afternoon, Steve. My question is in regards to Matthew 16:13-20. Mark 8:27-29, and Luke chapter 9, verses 18-20.
Okay,
Peter correctly replies to Jesus' question, "Who do you say I am?" Mm-hmm. Why does Jesus order his disciples not to divulge his identity as the Messiah?
Okay. Thank you for your call. When Jesus asked his disciples, "Whom do men say that I am?" and Peter said, "You're the Christ or the Messiah, the Son of the living God," one thing Jesus said to them was, "Don't tell anyone that I'm the Christ until after I've risen from the dead." And he gave those kind of instructions on other occasions, too. For example, at the Transfiguration, where three disciples and he were at the top of the mountain, and Moses and Elijah appeared and were talking. And Jesus also told the disciples as they went down the mountain, "Don't tell anyone about this until later." And there were times when Jesus told people not to talk to anyone about the healing he'd done. For one thing, Jesus very clearly was not a self-promoter at all. There are times, for example, when he did come down from the Mount of Transfiguration, he found nine of his disciples were down there trying to cast a demon out of a boy. And he held a conversation with the Father, and it says in the Scripture that when Jesus saw that a crowd was gathering, he broke off the conversation and just cast the demon out of the boy. In other words, he wanted to do the miracle and help him without a crowd gathered. He was not trying to make a spectacle of himself. He did miracles because people needed them. But he was not at all a self-promoter. And you see that again and again. He says, don't tell anyone about this. Don't tell anyone about this. Now, why? Why would he not promote himself? There's more than one reason, I think. One is, of course, that he was interested only in being promoted by his father. And I can understand that. I mean, ever since I've been in this, I have loathed to advertise or promote myself just because I feel like, what if I do that? And then I have a successful ministry. I'll never know if I'm successful because God favors my ministry or because I promoted it. And so I just thought, well, that'll be easy to figure out. I just don't promote it, and we'll see what God does. And I think Jesus was of that opinion, too. Not that he and I are really alike each other in every respect, but I try. And I do think that was his attitude. I think probably every minister should have that as their attitude, but that's between them and God. I think Jesus wanted to make sure that he didn't build something that his father was not building. And he could. Anyone who's got the power to raise the dead and open the eyes of the blind and do those kind of things publicly, he could build himself a huge ministry if he was so inclined. But remember, he hadn't even told his disciples that he was the Messiah at this point. And they'd been with him for over 2 years. And when he said, who do you say I am? And Peter said, you're the Messiah. Jesus said, well, blessed are you, because flesh and blood has not revealed this to you. My Father revealed that to you. In other words, he recognized, I didn't tell you, people didn't tell you. You know this because my Father told you, and that's the way I like it. Let the Father promote me. Let the Father reveal to people who I am. I'll do his will, and I'll just leave my reputation in his hands, which is a wonderful and restful way to conduct ministry where you're not struggling to promote yourself or whatever. Now, that's one thing. I think he may have just wanted the Father to promote him, but there's another thing, too, and that is that Jesus didn't want the people to take their ideas of what the Messiah was and apply them to him and force him into their popular mold. They thought the Messiah was going to be a conquering king who would fight the Romans off and deliver the people from the Romans. Jesus didn't want to do that, but people were so, you know, on the edge looking for the Messiah to do that for them, that there came a time in John 6:15 where it says, after he fed the multitudes, he saw that the people were about to take him by force and make him king. In other words, they were going to take him by force and set him at their head to lead them against the Romans so they could be set free. That's what they wanted the Messiah to do. And Jesus said, well, I am the Messiah, but don't tell people I am, because they're likely to take that wrong. They're going to get it wrong, I think. And another thing, too, is I don't think that I know it says in 1 Corinthians 2 that Jesus' death and resurrection and the way he accomplished his mission was a mystery that the rulers of this age did not know. And it says, if they had known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. I don't think even Satan and the demons understood that Jesus was going to die and conquer them that way. And if they had known it, I don't think they would have inspired Judas and Caiaphas and Pilate and so forth to do the things they did. So Jesus didn't really want to give away the strategy. He was an invading force into the devil's world, the devil's territory at least. And, you know, when you come in with an invading force, you don't give away your strategy to the other side. If Satan had understood what Jesus was up to, it might be that he wouldn't have, you know, no one would have crucified him. And that was a necessary part. So I think there's reasons why Jesus wanted to keep these things close to his chest and told the disciples, just don't talk about this until after, you know, afterward. When I've risen from the dead, then you can tell everybody about this stuff. All right? Who's our next caller, Sam? Okay, brother. Thank you for your call.
Okay, let me get our next caller taken care of. We are going to Mark.
Mark? Mark in Eagan, Minnesota. Hi, Mark. Good to hear from you again.
Hello, sir. Fifth time caller.
Yeah.
Got a question on guardian angels. We were talking in our Bible study. Our leader said that he felt that or heard that we have guardian angels, like maybe even assigned to us. I read in Exodus 23:20-21 is one verse, and also Matthew 18:10. Is another one that might allude to that, but I was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, Matthew 18:10, I assume, is the passage that talks about the children having angels.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, the Bible does suggest, I mean, I think the easiest way to interpret that statement of Jesus is that children do have guardian angels, or at least angel advocates who see the face of the Father, Jesus said. You know, he said, be careful not to wrong these little ones or offend these little ones because their angel, beholds the face of God and so forth, which that's an obscure statement, but I think the easiest way to understand is that God does have angels assigned to children. And you might say, well, then how come so many children suffer horrible things? Well, the Bible indicates that God has angels assigned to all Christians, too. And yet horrible things happen to Christians. God takes care of his people, but he also has it's in his plan that we go through certain kinds of tests and so forth. And so he does allow things to happen to us that he must call off the guard, call off the angels for the moment, stand down, let this trial enter this person's life. Because, it says in Psalm 37, Psalm 34, I think it's verse 7, that says that the angel of the Lord encamps around about those who fear him and delivers them. And it says in Psalm 91, 11 and 12, he's given his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways, and in their hands they'll bear you up lest you dash your foot against a stone. So there are angels that are assigned to the protection of the righteous. I guess we could call them guardian angels. I mean, I don't know if there's like one angel assigned per person or what. I don't even know I don't even know what good it would do for me to know the answer to that question. I mean, what I do know is that God has resources deployed in the service of his people. It says in Hebrews, it's in Hebrews 1:14, it says that the angels are ministering, which means serving spirits who are sent forth to serve those who are the heirs of salvation. So I would say that it appears to me that God does have angels deployed to minister to the needs of both children and also his children, believers. And I guess the practical value of knowing that is that whatever happens to me that I wish had not happened could have been prevented if God had wished, because he has angels quite capable and on assignment to protect me. But he must have decided in this instance that it's in the best interest of his program and of my good, ultimately, to allow this difficulty into my life, like he did with Job.
Yeah. Now,
Before Satan was able to afflict Job, Satan complained. He said to God, I can't touch him or anything he has because you've put a hedge around him. My suspicion is that hedge is either the same or at least analogous to angels, the angel of the Lord encamping around the righteous. So I'm of the opinion that we are protected from everything that God wishes to protect us from. And Jesus said, not a sparrow falls to the ground without the will of your Father. And he said that to his disciples in a context, say, so don't worry about yourself. You're worth more than many sparrows. So, I mean, you can't die unless your Father wants you to. In fact, not even a sparrow can die unless your Father wants it to. And the hairs of your head are numbered. So the point here is that God is so involved with each of us and so attentive to us, and the angels are among his resources that he assigns to our care, that, bad things sometimes may happen, but not without his will. And that's what's encouraging to me. When Job lost everything, he had this faith too. He said, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He figured, well, God, I belong to God. If he wants to take stuff away, that's his business. He gave it to me, so he can take it away from me. And that's true of everyone who really believes God in a biblical sense. I believe that everything I have, including my life and breath, is a gift from God. He's got every right, if he wishes, to take every one of those things from me at any given time. And yet he doesn't. He does some. Eventually he does. But we have so many days of our lives where God doesn't take things from us that he could. And no doubt, those who are malicious toward us, Satan and the malicious spirits and so forth, would love to take those things from us all the time, but we got this hedge about us, which I would identify as the angels, the angelic bodyguard, you know. So that's how I would see it based on those scriptures I've mentioned.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call.
Yep.
All right. Sam, who's next?
Next, we have Barbara from Roseville, Michigan.
Okay, Barbara from Roseville, Michigan. Hi, Barbara. Good
evening. Oh, hi, Steve. Hi, Steve. I have two questions, but I do want to comment on the global warming, and I want to see what you think of my comment. Global warming is real, but it's not what people think. The Bible says that hail is enlarging itself, and if people want to get rid of global warming, they got to live right. And all this other stuff they're doing, it's going to keep getting hotter and hotter. But my two questions are how Eve was talking to the serpent in the garden. Do you believe that they were able to talk to all animals prior to the fall? And the other question is, all these sacrifices that God is consuming and that, you know, different people have offered up to him, Solomon, hundreds of thousands of rams or whatever. Is God eating these sacrifices?
Okay, let's talk about animals talking. C.S. Lewis is among those who thinks that before the fall, animals perhaps were able to speak. I do not follow him in this, although I like C.S. Lewis. I don't think that's likely. To my mind, I don't think that God made animals rational. And to actually, you know, communicate with speech requires that you put sentences together and you understand the meaning of the words and things like that, which requires a certain rationality that I don't believe animals have. Also, most animals don't have the physical apparatus to verbalize words and things. Now, there are exceptions. You know, you've got parrots and minor birds and stuff that can mimic human speech and sound almost like a human being. In fact, if they know enough phrases, you'd almost think that they are able to converse, like that they can think and they know what they're saying and so forth. However, it's almost certain they don't know what they're saying. They're just mimicking sounds, and they do it very well. I think that when the serpent spoke to Eve, I don't think that she had a view of whether serpents could speak or not. She was brand new. I believe that she had been created extremely recently, like the day before or 2 days before, in all likelihood. I don't know that to be true, but certainly the impression is she and Adam fell very early on. And it's very likely that someone so recently created would be acquainted intimately with all the different animals and might even have known that there are animals that speak. I mean, not rationally, but again, she might have known that some birds and creatures can imitate human speech. So it might not have taken her aback. She might not have been shocked when this creature spoke. I doubt that she was herself thinking clearly enough to say, okay, I've heard animals speak before, but this one sounds like he's, you know, thinking like a person. Now, we believe, those of us who believe the story is true, believe that Satan was speaking through him, through the serpent. And, you know, we know, frankly, those of us who have encountered demon-possessed people and so forth, you know that demons can speak through the voice of people. And sometimes even to speak independently of the animals or the humans' vocal apparatus. I mean, there are demonically possessed people from whom multiple voices speak at the same time from their mouths. Now, I don't think your vocal cords can pull that off, but it would appear that the demonic power includes the ability to project speech through a mouth of a person who doesn't really have the capacity to speak three voices in different languages simultaneously. And if that's true, then I have no doubt the devil could no doubt speak through a snake with or without the use of its own physical apparatus. Snakes don't really have voices. They hiss, and therefore they don't have the apparatus in their throat to project words like we do, but that doesn't mean the devil couldn't do it through them. Now, you know, this whole idea of a snake speaking and things like that has just seemed silly in the minds of most modern people.
I've heard lots of people who ridicule the Bible giving this as an example. You think a snake talked? Do you think a donkey talked? No, I don't think a snake talked exactly. I think that the devil talked using a snake. And I don't think a donkey really talked any more than a parrot talks. But I believe God spoke through the donkey. But in any case, God and Satan are both part of my worldview, which makes those kinds of things a possibility. But as to Eve's reaction, I think what you're wondering is, you know, why didn't she notice that? Something strange. Did animals talk? I don't think they did. I don't think they did. But some of them probably, as now, were known to mimic human speech. And she might not have been caught too alarmed, since she was maybe 1 or 2 days old herself. She probably didn't know what's normal and what's not normal yet. She's probably very much in the beginning stages of discovery of the creation around her.
Okay,
thank you, Barbara. God bless.
Sacrifices.
Okay, Sam. Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. I forgot you had a second question. I was going to move on to another caller because it's getting late. But you should. Does God eat the sacrifices? No, God doesn't have a stomach. He doesn't have a mouth. He's a spirit. Sometimes the animals sacrificed were seen as an offering of meals to the gods when pagans offered sacrifices, because their gods, they weren't so sure, but that they might have stomachs. I mean, the Greek gods up on Mount Olympus, I think, were conceived as at least quasi-physical beings and so forth. And when pagans offered their gods, I think they may have thought that the gods really were eating them. But what did
God do with the sacrifices?
He observed them. You know, what they did is they burned these animals up. The smoke went up as a sweet aroma, the Bible says, and he observed it as a pleasant thing that people were offering to him. But I mean, in Psalm 50, God says, you know, if I was hungry, I wouldn't ask you. I own all the cattle on 1,000 hills, you know.
But
so.
I know at least one of them, they say he consumed it, and it must have disappeared or something. I can't quote it. But
I'm not sure what you're thinking of. The fire consumed it. Yeah, when Elijah put the sacrifice on the altar on Mount Carmel, fire from heaven came down and consumed it. That's true. But that doesn't mean that God ate it. The fire consumes things by burning them up, generally speaking. All right, anyone good? I don't have much time. I need to take another call, but I hope that's helpful to you, Barbara. Thanks. Yeah. Okay. Patricia from Diamond Bar, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I'm a public school teacher, and the curriculum teaches that about the first Americans, the Ice Age, and then coming over on the Bering Strait and prehistoric people. Is teaching that non-biblical?
Not necessarily that. Certainly your curriculum is assuming a great number of things that are unbiblical that allegedly took place before that time. Your curriculum might think that these people came across, you know, 100,000 years ago, and we might think biblically it wasn't that long ago that they did. But there's nothing unbiblical at the suggestion that the first North American, native peoples, or who became the native peoples there, had come from Russia across the Bering Strait. I guess we don't know that for sure, but it seems like the best theory given the evidence we have. We know they came from somewhere, and even the Bible would say that from Noah's Ark, all the earth was overspread by the descendants of Noah. So since North America is not where the ark landed, people had to get to North America from Mount Ararat in Turkey, before they had to get there somehow, and that they would cross the Bering Sea is a very doable theory. But we don't know for sure. I mean, basically, I think the assumption is, since the Native American peoples, as we call them, tend to have racial affinity with Asian peoples more than, say, with European peoples, that they may have descended from people who are from the Asian regions. And of course, Russia is not Asia, but it's right there with it. And so that's, I think that there's some reasonable speculation about that. But as a teacher, you don't have to feel like you're violating your Christian faith. I would think you'd frankly encounter a lot more things as a school teacher that would be objectionable to you than that. Yeah.
That's for sure. So other than the timeline, it's fine.
Right. I myself would question their timeline, although you didn't mention what year they said it is, but I'm guessing that they would probably put it pretty far back, maybe further back than I would imagine. But I don't worry about timelines that much either. I mean, the main issue is, are they teaching the children to dispute whether God is the creator, whether God has, you know, is over all people, and that all people came from one blood and one mm-hmm. people originally. I would say those particular scenarios that you mentioned are not hostile to that.
Okay, very good. All right. Thank you, Steve.
And you might, I mean, I don't know what you're allowed to do as a teacher in a public school, but, I mean, you could always say this is the prevailing theory that people have.
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, people don't really know for sure some of these things, but it's a decent theory. And as long as you say this is the prevailing theory right now that people have, then even if you thought the theory was untrue, you'd at least be telling the truth. It is the prevailing theory, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you could even do the same thing even with, say, let's just say you're a creationist, not an evolutionist. I would think that you could talk about evolution, say this is the prevailing opinion of many scientists. You might mention mm-hmm. just in passing, some scientists have different opinions, but this is the popular opinion right now.
Yeah. Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey, I appreciate your call. God bless you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Now, we might have time for one more call. I'm not sure. What do you think, Sam? Noah from Connecticut, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. I know we are out of time here, but I'm just going to ask one question. I have three, but I'm going to stick with one for now. So I used to be part of a church that, they believe in speaking in tongues. And they said they want to lay hands on you to prove that you receive the gift of the Spirit. And they will speak in these languages that you don't understand. So I know I spoke to you a lot ago, and you said, yes, the gift of tongues is still around. But is this something that is audible? Is this something that you can understand? Or is this these voices that, like, speaking into something that is not actually a language?
Well, the Bible indicates that when a person speaks in tongues, it's supernatural gift. And Paul says, if I speak in an unknown tongue, my understanding is unfruitful, which I think is commonly thought to mean he doesn't understand what he's saying. In 1 Corinthians 14:2, Paul said that a person who speaks in tongues does not speak to men, but to God, because no one understands him, he says. Now, there are some uses of tongues different than what Paul's referring to. For example, on the day of Pentecost, when you're not in the church, but you're, you know, among unbelievers, speaking in tongues may be an understandable language to them, as it was on Pentecost. But when you're in the church, that's not what's happening. In the church, it's a different kind of a language that no one understands and needs an interpreter. That's why Paul said, you know, don't let anyone speak in tongues if there's not an interpreter present. Because it's understood that you need the gift of interpretation to make sense of it, because it's not a language anyone naturally understands there. So there's more that could be said, but I'm out of time on this. I appreciate your call. We'll no doubt have this subject arise again sometime in the future. But I need to close down. Thanks for your call, Noah. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live Monday through Friday. Listener supported. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Our website, where everything is free, but you can also donate if you wish, is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.